And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show for Friday, September 1st. Derek Van Riper here with Keith Law. We have a resolution to this week's Waiver Palooza. Thank you to Artie Moreno and the Angels for putting so many interesting players available through waivers. It was a big waiver week, Keith. I didn't see it coming.
It was a big giveaway, right?
It was a big giveaway.
You got anybody?
I tried to claim Harrison Bader. I need some help in center field. Need a good defensive center fielder. And the Reds have been a little worse than me this year, so they had priority. So
that's true.
We have destinations for a lot of players. The Guardians ended up with Lucas Giolito, Ronaldo Lopez, and Matt Moore for nothing.
Yep.
Two good relievers, two very good relievers, and a starter who has really been struggling during his time with the Angels, wasn't pitching as well as he pitched in previous seasons with the White Sox before going to the Angels. Let's just start with Giolito. I mean, clearly the Guardians need a veteran to chew up innings at a minimum, even in the wake of letting Noah Syndergaard go. Their track record with pitching is very good over the past decade or so. What do you think they're going to get from Giolito over the final month of the season, given what we've just seen over the course of August from him with the Angels?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I'm looking at August as kind of a pretty small sample, first of all, where also he faced three really good offenses in five starts, right? He faced Atlanta and got bombed. He faced Texas and was not great. And then he faced the Phillies. I was actually at that game with friends, a very rare occasion where I'm actually at a baseball game and not working. Although, of course, they did go up the line just to get a better look at Nolan Chanuel. You know, I think that was another one where Giolito actually probably pitched a little bit better than the line said at the end. And there were definitely some little pitch selection questions that I had, but I think it was one of those. He kind of deserved a little bit of a better fate than he got there. Also, the Phillies are a really good lineup with a good bit of power. So, you know, I look at, like I said, it's a month. It's five starts with a little bit of a skew in the quality of competition he was facing. I think Giolito is better than that. He was better than that the 4 months prior to the trade to the Angels. I think the stuff points to him being a little bit better. I would expect a better result from, I mean, God, he had a near 7 ERA while he was with the Angels and became like suddenly way more homer prone. I'm not buying that. I think he'll be better with the Guardians, even if it's just a matter of regression to kind of his own mean, his own true talent level. So for me, I love it for the Guardians. I can't believe that they did that. The Guardians are actually taking on, granted, a relatively meager amount of money in baseball terms, but they're taking on money. Good job.
They can use this as an example of, see, we take on cash.
We take on cash.
Mm-hmm. We'll spend 5 games behind the Twins right now as play begins on Thursday. So easily a gap that can be closed in a month. No doubt about that. If you're a Twins fan, you're kind of frustrated by the state of things. I wonder, do you think the waiver trade deadline back when we had that system was actually better than players just being freely available by the, you know, standings order with tiebreakers that we have now? Like, was the old system actually better?
I preferred it. That I think that ultimately, I never quite understood why Major League Baseball opposed it. There are things for the players, right? And I don't really know or want to speak for the players' considerations. Like, look at what just happened with Giolito and Lopez, right? You just got bounced from Chicago to Anaheim to Cleveland, and they had basically no say in the matter. Like, that's not great. And I understand players and the union want to have a system where players have a little more input on where they're getting to go play. And obviously, these guys are free agents this winter, and then they will get that say. So I'm not saying they have no agency, but they, you know, in this particular case, right, they just got shuttled around like property, and that's not good. I liked the old system. I thought the whole waiver thing was just kind of annoying, that you had to get guys through waivers and then people would be reporting on them. And I remember when I was at front office, there was like a $100,000 fine to the team if you ever leaked any information on who was on waivers or who got through waivers. I was like, this is stupid. That's really arcane. Like, what are we? Why? This is not player friendly and it's not fan friendly. Maybe just make the trade deadline a little later, August 15th or something. Like, I don't know why the trade deadline has to be as early as it is. I think it's exciting. It's a good thing for baseball. Anything we do that generates a lot of interest, like, for example, a lot of trades happening at the same time, that gets a lot of people excited and a lot of chatter going. And that, to me, is a bit of a lost opportunity that they do it early. I mean, we get some attention, but doing it later might lead to bigger trades because more teams, by the later you go in the season, the more teams are willing to say, we're just, this isn't our year. And we're willing to do something. I mean, in a different universe, should the Angels, whatever, lose 8 straight to start August to decide, fine, we're trading Ohtani after all. Like, we miss out on that. I'm fine with one deadline. I wish it was later. And this whole system, which is basically a non-trade trade, right, where the Cleveland just traded air for 3 guys, it still amounts to a trade that feels like we're just sort of circumventing the whole process. And that none of that sits particularly well with me. Nothing against what Cleveland's doing. Good for them. I think it's great. It's just, this feels like we are now working around a process, working around a stricter rule that, hey, if teams are just finding ways around this, maybe we need to find a different way to legislate this.
Right. I think there's a couple things here. If you push the trade deadline too far back, how does that impact the teams trying to get future value? Giving up only 1 month of a player, prospect returns used to be better at the trade deadline than they are now, right? We don't see as many top 100 prospects get flipped now as we did 10 plus years ago. My question would be, if you move that deadline back, do those returns get even worse because you're getting upgrades for an even shorter period of time?
Yeah, I don't know, because I think the price of trades, the returns in trades have gone down for totally different reasons. It's just the recognition that prospects and very young or low service time big leaguers are worth so much more. That's just driven them down, and that's probably our new normal. Will there be slightly less return if it's August 15th rather than July 31st? Probably. That would stand to reason. Flip side is, one thing I never really quite understood is, why does everybody just wait till the deadline? Why wouldn't you get aggressive? Like, was it CC Sabathia was traded to the Brewers? It was like early July, and it made a huge difference. I think I have the right trade where somebody sort of jumped early, and it really moved. It made a huge difference for the Brewers that year, just getting 2-3 extra starts or you know, 12 extra games for a position player. That's a huge difference. Why wouldn't you try to do that? So maybe the solution is, I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, because I don't really know what the obstacles are to doing a deal earlier, other than maybe just more teams thinking we're still in it. Or lacking the urgency or pressure of a deadline. They're just not doing anything. They're not as inclined to do anything. I don't know. There's no reason all the trades have to happen within 72 hours of the deadline. If I were running a team that was contending and we have a pretty clear hole here, I'd at least try to be aggressive and go out and find somebody sooner. Maybe the point is other teams just aren't willing to sell at that point. I don't honestly know what the actual obstacle is and what the solution might be.
I've wondered about that for a few years. The sooner you trade for that player, the longer the window is for them to have an impact to make your roster better. And we've seen year over year, division races, wild card races, every playoff spot can come down to one game. So the sooner you act, the more likely it is that you're going to get the boost that you actually need. If you're the team trading players away, presumably you get a better return. Right, you've got more teams to deal with also, more teams that believe they're going to be a playoff team that year. So I think that's a good thing, too, from the perspective of the team that is moving present talent for future value. July 7th, 2008 was the date of that CC Sabathia trade. I am certain, Keith, there is a bar somewhere in Milwaukee on July 7th that will give you free alcohol if you mention that trade on that day. They celebrate that day. I am sure of it. There's at least one. There has to be, because that was a great day in Brewers history. Probably one of the most beloved players who spent less than a season in Milwaukee. It was great all-in push.
Yep.
As far as the Guardians Twins go, if you're projecting it right now, a five-game lead is enough where you lean on the side of the Twins, but nothing's impossible. You look at the upcoming schedule, they meet up again next week for a three-game series in Cleveland. That's a pretty big series because I believe that's the last of their meetings for the rest of this season. So that's their best chance to just cut into that gap all at once without having to rely on other teams helping them out. Who do you take to win the AL Central? Do you take the Twins with the five-game lead in hand, even with these additions for the Guardians?
Yeah, but hopefully this makes it close, interesting, right? I don't care which team ultimately wins. I'm picking the Twins because that's just logical, right? With a five-game lead with, 30 to play-ish, that's just the safe bet. However, if this makes the division more interesting, great. That's awesome.
Yeah,
I love it. I don't want to see anybody coast to a division title. That's boring.
I'm here for anything that makes the division races more interesting. We talked a lot about the NL Central getting more interesting with that Cubs-Brewers series this week on the Thursday episode of this podcast. And I think the broader problem for the Guardians is very similar to the problem that the Brewers have. Brewers have more power. Guardians strike out less. They just don't score enough. And I think with all the additions they made, they still need another bat.
Yeah.
Of all the things you could have got, Randall Grichuk went unclaimed. They must not have thought Randall Grichuk would make them better compared to the guys currently on the depth chart. So I guess that's part of it, right? Like, I think their specific problem, because it's power, I actually think there's a case for it. Ordinarily, in a vacuum, overall value, no, I don't think Randall Grichuk's that good, but I think he actually fills a need for them. So maybe that was a missed opportunity.
I mean, he's kind of a platoon bat, right? It's basically what he's been for most of his career. It's a nice little career, actually, for a guy whose main claim to fame is that he's not Mike Trout. He's a guy who's picked one spot before Mike Trout. Like, Grichuk was... I wasn't a big believer in Grichuk. He's outperformed my expectations, certainly. And he's turned into, decent platoon bat. You know, not very good versus righties, not absolutely hopeless, but more power. You need somebody to come in and give you a shot at a homer off a lefty. He's your guy. That's a tough guy to fit, right? That's just, that's a very specific need. Maybe that's a better way to say it. You have to have a very specifically shaped, like he is a very specifically shaped peg and you need a specifically shaped hole to fit him into. And so that could be why he got through ultimately, why he got through waivers, I mean.
Well, and I think the other aspect of this, if you're a Guardians fan, you say, yeah, we could have used power. You claimed three players. That means you have to move three players off of the roster. Like, that's actually easy to do for a team that's not bad.
You know, I didn't even look at that. Have they announced? We're recording this. It's almost 2:00 Eastern on Thursday. Have they announced who they're taking off the 40 or possibly moving to the 60 day, which I guess temporarily removes a guy from the 40 just to make room? They released Syndergaard the other day, but I think that was to make room for somebody else, right?
Right.
They designated him for assignment to put Daniel Norris on the roster. I'm cheating. I had to call this up because I didn't know. I definitely did not know this. And then the next day, designated Norris for assignment to call Gattis up and then just release Syndergaard, but he'd already been removed from the 40. So, yeah, we're going to have to see how many spots they're going to have to move somebody off. And I mean, the Guardians, from having a pretty productive farm system the last several years, have a lot of guys on the 40 who are not in the majors, but they really can't slash shouldn't take off. You know, Brian Rocchio, I think, is a stud prospect. Jose Tena has really come on the last couple of months, started to look a lot more like the hitter he seemed to be 2 years ago when he made my top 100 and was one of the most exciting guys in fall league, even though he was very young. George Valera, a bit of the broad range of opinions, but definitely a prospect, definitely not somebody you're just kicking off the roster. Right? These are not Juan Brito, they just got in the Nolan Jones trade. I'm mentioning these guys because they're 40-man guys who are not on the active roster. And so those are guys you can't just easily just take off their prospects. They're all got, those spots are locked in addition to, you know, the vast majority of the guys in your major league roster are also not guys you're looking to kick off. I mean, I can look here and I can see a couple guys where, sure, you know, maybe you kick Hunter Gaddis off because you just called him up and you can, all right, well, he's one of the guys, these three pitchers are replaced. They're replacing three pitchers on the active roster. But this is a little bit of a 40-man crunch situation for Cleveland. I wonder if they just kind of thought, maybe we'll get one. Like, you really would like to see the scene when their AGM gets the email. Guys, we got three. We got everybody. Like, good, but...
It's good, but now, yeah, it's like, oh, we didn't quite expect to get three. So now what corresponding moves do we have? And sometimes you see guys shift to the 60-day IL. That could be maybe an option for somebody. So there's a few different paths to make the room.
Is Quantrill still, I'm sorry, this is like such niche content here, but I also love this stuff. I mean, it reminds me of 20 years ago, right? Trying to figure out who to put where. There is some small grace period. I'm not saying what it is because I don't remember. I'm sure it's different from when I was at the Blue Jays, but you don't have to put Giolito on the 40-man like the very minute, right? You have a moment to move some guys around. But yeah, I love this stuff.
But you got to be postseason eligible by getting on the roster before a certain deadline.
Oh, that's true.
Is there a person in every organization, like at least one, who is just solely focused on the machinations of the 40-man roster? The waivers, all these rules. It's the AGM usually?
Usually their job is to be the one managing that, at least to be the one to come and say, oh, here are our options. All right, we need to call somebody up. Okay, this guy can go on the 60-day or we could designate this guy for assignment. That is the person, ostensibly the assistant GM is the one who manages that part of the process and knows what's feasible and what the rules are. And okay, this guy has to be activated by this time. Oh, Cal Quantrill, if we put him on the 60-day, but he'd actually be eligible to come off within a day because it would be actually technically, if he went on, I think I read July 1st. No, I'm sorry, it's July 6th. So he couldn't do that. So my whole great idea actually doesn't work. Say that he'd gone on July 1st, hypothetically. He could have gone on the 60-day just for 24 hours and been activated tomorrow, because 60 days would have passed since the time. So you retroactively place him on the 60-day, retroactive to the date he actually went on the 15-day. He can still be activated 60 days from that point, which actually would have been yesterday if I'd gotten the date right. But I got the date wrong, so none of this actually matters. This is all extremely hypothetical.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So people know that you are very into board games. Mm-hmm. What board game is most like Major League Baseball's roster rules in terms of how complex the rules are?
Oh, if you want complexity, I mean, I could start naming games I really don't like.
How about one that you do like, but has about as many twists and turns as managing an MLB roster?
There was one I played just a couple of months ago. I'm going to pick a new one just because it's been more interesting, but called Barcelona, which is from a publisher, actually a Polish publisher, Board and Dice, that specializes in crunchier games, games that tend to take 90 minutes to 2 hours. They tend to be bigger boxes with, you know, physically heavier games in addition to being heavier weight. And that was another one where, you know, the better, I don't mind longer games like that. 2 hours is about my max, where I just start to like get dizzy and, you know, need to go lie down. But the games like that really work generally require you to manage three or four different things, your progress in three or four different areas. Zolkin, which is T-Z-O-L-K-I-N, is another great heavier game like that where you're managing at least four different things. And it's I always describe it as having a higher cognitive load, right? It's asking more of your brain to juggle these different things where you need some balance. Generally, in those games, you can't ignore any of those things. But also, you want to specialize a little bit and say, I'm going to get most of my points from doing this one thing. And the best games force you to make a lot of decisions like that. And so you spend the entire, you are thinking a lot during the entire game. Some people say that's not fun. And I completely understand that. I enjoy that because it's a challenge. It's a puzzle that can't ever be quite solved, but there is a winner. So that's something like solving the puzzle, but then generally makes me want to come back and do it again because I say, oh, I did this wrong, or I could have done better in this particular area. And it's the juggling, like the mental juggling part that I particularly enjoy. But like I said, I recognize that's not for everyone. And those are often, those are games I don't often recommend to readers because I know that's a niche. That's a pretty small segment of at least my portion of my audience that's interested in my board game content. I have some of those. Some of you readers listen and enjoy those longer, crunchier games. But I recognize that's not the majority of the audience.
I just figured since we were talking about really in-depth roster stuff, made sense to get a game out there. And because Cones of Dunshire has never actually been made, we actually needed a real-life example. Let's talk about the Reds for a bit. They added two outfielders, Harrison Bader and Hunter Renfroe. Bader made a lot of sense for them because defensively in center field, the Reds are one of those teams that have lagged in terms of what they're getting on that side. My question for you about Harrison Bader is, why hasn't it worked for him as a hitter? And even over the course of his career, you could just say, well, he's been hurt a lot. So what percentage of the playing time that he's been available for in his big league career has come at anything close to 100% health? So he's going from one hitter friendly environment to a very homer friendly environment in Cincinnati. Do you think there's still one more level for Harrison Bader at the plate, or like the best versions of him offensively are still a possibility? Or do you think those days have passed?
I think those days have probably passed, but as you said, that ballpark does cure a lot of ills. I mean, it's just, it's tough. Like he's a low on base guy. He just kind of always is. Wouldn't shock me if he put a few more balls in the seats. I mean, he did 2 years ago. He hit 16 homers in 103 games. He's not without power. He's not much of a hitter. It's so funny. He's so different than the player I thought he was at Florida, where he played left field and didn't look particularly good doing it. When I saw him, at least, that was a year that Florida did have a first rounder. It was Richie Martin. Actually, wasn't Harrison Bader, but I think he's turned out to be the best player off that Florida roster. I was like, I think he can hit some, but he might be a tweener, right? Not really enough power for a corner, certainly not the defense for center. And then certainly less than 2 years in pro ball, it was pretty clear, oh no, this guy can really play defense. What the heck? It's entirely possible I just missed because I saw him either one or two games. Not great for evaluating defense. I also think he actually really got better in pro ball, which happens a lot, and that's made his career. And the bat has been less than I expected. If you'd shown me his career stat line, a 399 slug, I would have said, come on, I think there's a little more bat than that. I didn't think he was a 30 homer guy, but I thought there was a little more sock than we've seen. And I mean, shoot, it's not like Yankee Stadium's a tough place to hit either.
I wonder where he'll end up as a free agent this winter, because get him in the right org, get some new coaches in his ear, maybe they can find a way to get that out of him. But I think you can bring him in knowing that you're getting a Michael Taylor sort of player with less swing and miss.
That's
valuable to start. Like, you already have a guy you can play, but you also have a guy that you could maybe tweak and get a little more from him. So I thought that was a pretty good claim for the Reds and Renfroe being there too. Renfroe's not bad, but Hunter Renfroe, Keith, has this profile that major league teams temporarily want Hunter Renfroe and players like him, but they never want Hunter Renfroe on a multi-year deal, especially on the wrong side of 30. He's 31 years old now. I feel like Hunter Renfroe's got one or two more stops in his big league career in the next 2 to 3 seasons, and then Hunter Renfroe is gone. Sixth team in 6 years, right?
Yeah, sixth team in actually just less than 6 years, which is in itself, like, that's fine, right? That's you're a big leaguer. That's awesome. And when I was a kid, I always enjoyed those baseball cards, right? Where it's a whole bunch of teams. It's like, oh, this is interesting. either the sort of beauty of the Cal Ripken, Tony Gwynn, who plays an entire career with one team. Mm-hmm. I remember Jim Cott's baseball card, which had the original, he was the last player from the original Senators to still be playing in the big leagues. I remember asking my mom, like, who were the Senators? And her explaining they became the Twins, et cetera. Like, his was super interesting. Look at all these teams he's played for. Yeah, Renfro's having that kind of career just in miniature, right? He's doing it really fast. And that's because you want to talk about a platoon guy. This is kind of who he's always been. When he was a prospect, this is who he really was. This guy can really hit lefties. And that's kind of it. Well, and he's a very capable defensive corner outfielder, which teams don't really value that much unless you're elite. But yeah, 282 on base against righties, 462 slug, which is not nothing, but still, you're kind of close to an automatic out against righties. 344 on base against lefties, 529 slug. That's a really good player. He's really useful when deployed correctly, and perfect as this waiver claim deadline deal guy, right? That is exactly the kind of guy you're looking to add because we're in the middle of the season. We know our strengths and weaknesses. This is a very clear hole in the roster that we need to address. And Renfro, his skill set is quite specific. It's more than great, right? A broader platoon split than Grichuk. He's better even against lefties. So as a sort of tactical player on the bench, platoon starter, it's very clear how best to use him.
The other player that we know was claimed was Dominic Leone going back to Seattle, just adding some depth in that bullpen. Not a whole lot to dig into there. So we'll see if anybody else ends up with a new home in the remaining time that we're recording. It looks like Carlos Carrasco cleared waivers. Doesn't mean he won't end up on a new team. Just means if he's going to get there, it's going to be a release and then a team signing him. And that limits his eligibility for the postseason, too, because it'll be after that deadline if it plays out way.
Yeah.
We got some prospects to talk about. The Yankees, they're doing it. You thought maybe it was a bit of a rush job to bring up Jason Dominguez if they did it. He's coming up. They're getting real young real fast, actually. Austin Wells is coming up. Everson Pereira already up. So this is weird. It's not the Yankees team that anybody signed up for at the beginning of the season, but I think they're doing it right in the sense that they're giving some guys a look that might have been kind of iffy for the beginning of 2024. Like, you want to know what you have, and I think this is a better way to find out than letting these guys play in what is really a watered down AAA right now. I think that would be the best case for the more aggressive promotion. It's hard to learn a lot about a player in this iteration of AAA.
Yeah, AAA sucks right now.
It's real bad.
Yeah. It's the caliber of competition seems to be pretty inconsistent, right? There are plenty of guys in AAA who are a good test. I do think for pitchers, you are pitching to a lot of guys who've played in the big leagues at some point. There's certainly value in that. The thing that we're seeing, we've talked about this a ton, right? With the challenge system in AAA, walk rates are up. And so that can be misleading, certainly, in trying to evaluate hitters or pitchers. So, yeah, I wish it does seem like these moves were made without a lot of foresight, particularly Dominguez had been in AAA for what, less than 2 weeks? So
not long.
Certainly not long enough for it to matter. I mean, at that point, you could have just left him in AA, which makes me think probably 2-3 weeks ago, there wasn't a lot of thought to calling him up. And obviously, things changed at the major league level, and that's fine. You can change your process, you can change your plans. But it doesn't look as thoughtful as you would like from a player development perspective, certainly. And so to me, I don't think Jason Dominguez is ready to hit in the big leagues. I think Jason Dominguez is going to be a star. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he struggled or if he's good for, you know, a week or two and then the league starts to adjust and then he struggles after that and he has to turn around and make adjustments. And that's fine. That's part of players developing. But and at least what we saw with Dominguez over the course of this season, you could really trace it even back into last season, continuous improvement, which I'm a big, big fan of. You know, I think when you see continuous improvement in a player, particularly when scouts back it up and say we're seeing adjustments from the player, that's kind of one of the most positive things you can see from a development perspective. And it's a very positive indicator going forward. He will be able to continue to make adjustments. Generally, players who've made adjustments are able to continue making adjustments going forward. And I've particularly seen that with Dominguez, more than I've seen that with Pereira, much more than I've seen that with Wells. Wells is very limited. He may be a platoon guy. I really don't think he can catch on more than a backup or emergency basis. Dominguez is the one who's he's exciting. Like, I think that guy's, I do think he's going to be a star. I think he's going to play center. He's going to play it well. He's going to hit for some power eventually, maybe not right away. He's going to get on base at a good clip, and he's going to steal a bunch of bags. He may end up striking out a little more than you'd like, but I mean, that's also the game today too. So that's kind of a specious complaint.
A couple weeks ago, we suggested Ronnie Mauricio might get a look with the Mets. That's actually going to happen. Makes all the sense in the world, given what he was doing at AAA this year. As far as the development curve for Ronnie Mauricio against top-level pitching, do you think we're going to have any issues, like you talked about with Dominguez, where there's a lot of swing and miss, at least initially, because we haven't seen a lot in terms of walks from Ronnie Mauricio. So I just wonder, is it a hit tool that can hit everything and sort of get away with not working walks, or is it a problematic approach, at least initially?
He's really interesting because obviously I like players who show real plate discipline, right? Right. I want to see guys who show the ability to recognize balls and strikes, to recognize pitch types so that they make better swing decisions. Ultimately, this is all in service of better swing decisions. So in Mauricio's case, he's in that school of, he's a bit of a bad ball hitter. Like he doesn't swing and miss in the zone very much. So it's not an inability to put the bat on the ball. It might almost be too much of an ability to put the bat on the ball because he's so capable of making contact with on pitches out of the zone. I mean, he's got a really, I don't know, I don't have like a leaderboard, which would be certainly be helpful in this situation, but I don't see a lot of players who can go out of zone that often and still make this much contact. And he does. Does that trick work in the big leagues? It's tough to hit when it's 99 with high spin up at your eyes, right? At some point, he's probably going to have to not swing at those pitches. But for now, that's kind of how he's had success, is that pitchers can't just easily expand the zone on him kind of with impunity. They do actually have to make better pitches, and he can get that ball to a little bit out of the zone and kind of do something with it. It's also entirely possible to get to the big leagues and those pitches that he could square up well enough in double and triple A, especially, he's not going to be able to square up in the big leagues. He'll make contact, but it'll be bad contact. He'll make contact and it'll be foul contact. So I'm not trying to oversell. I think he's interesting. This is a type of player you don't generally see me say great things about. I've also seen Mauricio a lot. I have a decent amount of history with him, and I think he has a chance to be an exception. And, you know, I could be totally wrong. Somebody said Keith Law compared him to Alfonso Soriano. This was in an Athletic comment thread under his call-up. I said that's who he could be, right? That's kind of a best-case scenario. That's what that player looks like, and he does have things about his bat speed and his wrist strength that remind me of Soriano. I'm not saying he's going to be Soriano. That would be great. I don't actually think that's where this is going. Like, I think that's, you know, he's probably going to be a little bit less. I hope I'm right and he turns into Soriano, because I want all players to be good. And I think that you want to get a picture of what it looks like if it works out with Mauricio. That's your archetype.
An age to level gives his performances more of a boost, right? He's been young everywhere he's played, which makes the overall package more impressive. I think there's a conversation with Mauricio just about hit tool. I think hit tool would be really hard to put a grade on, Keith, for a whole bunch of the reasons that you just discussed with Mauricio, right? So if a player has great bat speed and makes below average swing decisions, but finds a way to hit pitches they shouldn't be able to hit, does that mean they have a good hit tool, an average hit tool? Like, even backing up further, what goes into your evaluation of a hit tool? How does it all kind of come together? How do you come up with a final grade for something that has a lot of moving parts in it?
And you said before we started recording, that might be the hardest tool. And I think it is. Of everything that I'm ever asked to evaluate, that scouts are asked to evaluate, I think the hit tool is the hardest one. Even if you're just talking about present hit tool, let alone talking about future hit tool, which is its own challenge, of course. It is very hard to evaluate. And part of it is this sort of ontological question of what is a hit tool? What actually do we mean when we're talking about evaluating a hit tool? And that's, but again, that's not, it's not easy, right? We don't necessarily agree on what we mean by a hit tool. By, or is it just the ability to put the bat on the ball? Is it the ability to make hard contact, which obviously is something we do really want? But at the same time, I have also learned that just making hard contact is in and of itself not really enough. So I think personally, what I'm looking for is some combination of all of these things. And that makes it a little bit, certainly makes it subjective and feel a little bit nebulous that, you know, what exactly do we mean by he's a good hitter. He can hit. You know, I often just use that expression, right? Oh, this guy, he can really hit. That to me means he's got some of all of these things or enough of a combination of these things that he's going to be able to make consistent, high quality contact. There's a couple ways to get there. You can be a super disciplined hitter who kind of only swings at strikes, maybe only makes medium quality contact. You can be a little bit of a less disciplined hitter, but you make enough contact and the contact you make is really high quality. So even if whether you hit over the fence or you're hitting a bunch to the gaps, there's a bunch of different ways to go about that too. There are quite a few options. There are quite a few possibilities for that to profile, for you to profile as an above average or plus hitter in time. So there are a lot of ways to go about it, and I prefer to keep it very open. I prefer to be open-minded myself because of experience, of recognizing guys do find different ways to become really good hitters. Jeff McNeil is a good example of a guy very clearly underrated. He doesn't fit an easy profile. The way he gets to it, and he used to get to it, obviously he's not doing it as much this year at all, but the way he was able to get to that is maybe not unique, but a lot less common. And those outlier players are the hardest ones to evaluate as a class. Chris Sale was a tough one for me, and one I got very wrong. And you know, if I'd been writing about Alfonso Soriano back in the day, I probably would have been wrong on him too. I remember with the Blue Jays, we weren't big fans because he seemed so undisciplined. And it's why I see a player like Mauricio, and I'm like, wait a second, I've seen someone sort of like this before, and I need to be more open-minded about it.
Yeah, I think it's a moving target. It's like the things that one guy should swing at are probably different than the things another guy should swing at because of your ability, right? Your ability to cover different corners of the strike zone effectively. If you can drive pitches on the outside edge the opposite way, that's probably a good idea. If you can't, you probably shouldn't swing at those pitches. You should probably work the count and try to get something you can drive. Like, so I think that's another, like, just each player's core skills as a hitter vary. And then the eye you should have needs to fit what you can do bat to ball. And there's such a wide range of things a group of players could do bat to ball that your plate discipline and my plate discipline and the plate discipline of these other guys over here, it varies based on just how good we are bat to ball. But do you think the scale in general, or even just the hit tool as a tool, needs to be broadened out? Should it be more than one thing? Should I be separated? Should your strike zone discernment be separated from the bat to ball and the contact quality things that people might be looking for? Contact quality does show up in the form of game power, raw power, right? It kind of gets into those categories. But just judging balls and strikes as a hitter almost seems like it's its own thing.
Yes. And most teams that I know of do somehow separate eye, plate discipline, whatever you want to call it. And to me, that can come down to strike zone judgment and to or ball strike recognition versus pitch recognition. Those are two separate skills. You can really know balls from strikes, but have trouble picking up spin, for example. So I also try to be, you know, fairly open-minded about, you know, when we're talking generally about plate discipline, or just get more specific ultimately and say, no, I'm talking about this one very clear thing. But most teams I know of do at least try to separate that out. And to me, there's hit, there's power, and then there's eye. And those, I think, should generally be broken out kind of as three separate things. They are separate skills to me. And the combination of them is important. But you can go about it a lot of different ways. So, you know, many teams, there are teams that don't really use pro scouts, for example, anymore, because they're just choosing to do it off of data, which I think is a huge failure. It's how a lot of people online who just have access to data and don't scout, don't know how to scout. They just pull up TrackMan data where it's available and then try to make judgments off of that, and you're missing a tremendous amount of context. But that data is also useful. And where do you count that? All right, his, you know, just to pick one, exit velocity is not a complete story, but say that you have a guy who posts pretty consistently high exit velocities. His max exit velocity or his 90th percentile exit velocities are excellent, say. Where does that fit? Great hit tool? Is that power? I don't think that's necessarily the same thing as power, because, right, if you're hitting like this versus the right, your angle off the bat, that's a huge difference. Can you hit for those high exit velocities, but also put the ball in the air on enough of a line that it's likely to get out of the park and not be like a really well hit F9, for example? It's not easy to separate these things into buckets. And I get away with this a little bit more because I'm less concerned about grades and much more concerned about telling the story of the player, because I get to work just in pros. Also, I never actually have to sign or trade for anybody, so the stakes are a little bit lower. That definitely helps.
Yeah, that definitely makes it easier.
Yeah, I just think it's a great question. I apologize for going on and on a little bit about it, but it, because it's an interesting one that I have grappled with my whole career. What do we really mean? Am I telling you, whether it's who I'm working for or telling the readers, am I telling you enough about the player? Do you have a complete picture, complete enough picture? And do you have a sense of what the potential variance in outcomes is too? It's very easy to say, this guy's got a plus hit tool. All right, what does that mean? Is he going to hit 320, 300? Nobody hits 320 anymore, except our IS, right? So, but what am I saying? Look, no player is that. They're not robots, right? You cannot look at any player and just say, this is what he's going to be. There's a range of outcomes. So expressing that also as part of it, which there's no grading system I know of that really gets to that. I know teams that have a separate box on the scouting report that is essentially variance, variability, probability. You know, I always refer to these guys as high beta, which is a term from the finance world, like a lot of variance in potential outcomes. That's important too. I think Ronnie Mauricio could actually turn out to be a really good hitter. He could also be awful. There's a lot of room there, you know, whereas Jackson Holliday, I think Jackson Holliday is going to turn out to be a really good hitter. And I don't think there's much range in potential outcomes. If he's anything less than a really, really good hitter, I will be extremely surprised.
Yeah, it's funny because when you have a much, much larger group of people you know in the scouting space, but even the few people I know, they'll use that expression, he can flat out hit. And I just think of like, Jose Altuve, like Luis Arraez might be the least powerful version of that player, but they're very different. Even as two guys that make a ton of contact, they do very different things as hitters. So that description, it's lacking, right? And I don't think it's meant to be the be-all, end-all, but I just think it's a really strange bucket to put a player in. It's like, well, what else can he do? He can flat out hit, but does he hit it in the air? Does he hit it on the ground? Does he hit it all over the place?
You know who is supposed to be that guy? Nick Madrigal. His advocates, he was picked fourth in the draft, which I thought was a reach. It was more of a reach than I realized, but I thought it was a reach. I thought he was like a mid-first rounder. And I thought he was a mid-first rounder. The guy puts the bat on the ball at exceptional rates. That's something. Doesn't necessarily mean a plus hit tool, but that is something. That's an actual skill. Now, it turns out he makes some of the weakest contact out of anybody. And it's sort of like scared me off to some extent of Jacob Wilson in this year's draft, where Wilson's a little bit of a bigger human, but still super high contact rates, very low contact quality. That player type has a hard time these days. Did Nick Madrigal have or project to have a plus hit tool with absolutely top of the line contact rates that have largely continued in the big leagues? He can still put the bat on the ball. It's like he's swinging a wet newspaper. Is that a good hit tool? Is that a 50, 55, 60? And that's, or is that a guy where everybody was just wrong? I mean, certainly the White Sox were wrong taking him fourth overall. They passed on some pretty good players in that draft, but I'm talking about in general, even people like me who weren't big Nick Madrigal fans who said, guy's kind of a twerp, right? And I say that as a twerp myself, so it's fine. I'm allowed to, but where did this go awry is the question. And you know, to me, that comes back to, in my opinion, at least, I mean, I'd be curious what you think as somebody who follows this stuff. To me, it's like, no, actually, he just wasn't, that just wasn't that good of a hit tool. Probably should have been like, it's more of an average hit tool. It's really high contact, but at the cost of all contact quality, that doesn't play anymore.
Right. So at the other end of the other end of the strikeout rate spectrum among hitters, Nick Madrigal has a 9.1% K rate. which is fantastic in a vacuum, right? Oh, you're going to strike out 9.1% of the time. That's great.
Yeah.
But at the other end, you get guys, Patrick Wisdom a few years ago, just staying in the same organization with K rates well north of 30%. And people say, that's just too much swing and miss. That's not going to work. And generally, it doesn't. But if you get to the power enough, the risk is worth the reward. The donuts are worth the actual payoff when he connects. And I also wondered, too, how much you can reasonably expect a player to improve and then sustain improvement with K rate over time. We saw a bit of a dip in the K rate last year for Wisdom. Got down from north of 40% in 2021 down to 34.3. You can sort of live with 34.3. And now he's kind of tracking back into the high 30s, right? So there, to me, it's just like there's a point where the lines intersect. You can have this much swing and miss if you do this much damage. And you can avoid whiffs at an elite level if you do just a little bit of damage. And Nick Madrigal doesn't even do a little bit of damage. It doesn't help you. There aren't enough ways, even without the strikeouts. You're not doing enough when you put the ball in play because you hit it on the ground. You hit it so softly, it's still not a hit. It's just it's an out a different way. It's with less certainty that it's an out compared to a strikeout, but not by as much as you'd think. And I wonder how much of the Madrigal, do you think there were there more old school scouts that looked at Nick Madrigal and had sort of some, hey, this worked in the 70s and 80s and 90s. There were players like this before. Maybe it can work again. Was there some of that going on because it was such an extreme contact heavy profile, like trying to retrofit an old profile into the modern game?
I think so. Personally, I also wonder when players like this come along, and I have experienced this firsthand, not firsthand, meaning I've heard it firsthand, seen it firsthand in my career. Not that people articulate this explicitly, but it's like, hey, this guy reminds me of me when I was a player.
Ah, that's never good, right?
Well, it doesn't work anymore. Players don't look like that, right? If you meet guys who played in the big leagues in the 80s and 90s, many of them would look out of place in a locker room in 2023, right? That just the size of players in Major League Baseball has changed pretty dramatically. Even I would just say in the 20 years since I've been in the industry, certainly since if you go back to the 80s, I always think of those Whitey Herzog Cardinals teams, right? Where they were smaller guys who put the ball in play and ran like crazy. And they got to, what, 3 World Series in 6 years by doing a lot of that. So that just, I don't think that formula works that well anymore.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB Show.
So another player that was recently promoted, Sidan Rafaela, has, I think, similar questions to Ronnie Mauricio, just in terms of the hit tool. Is the hit tool going to be good enough for everything else to come together? So I'm just curious, what's your overall assessment of Rafaela, and Do you think he's actually going to find a way to hit top level pitching?
Yeah, he's another one with that sort of bad ball. He certainly chases out of zone. I don't think he has quite the same contact on pitches out of the zone ability as Mauricio, but I think Rafael is a better athlete, a faster player, a twitchier player. He can absolutely play center field. Like that, he could come up right now and play center field every day the rest of the season and help the Red Sox. Like that is, to me, that is going to carry him a very long way. Even if he never really develops that much as a hitter, he'll have a decent career as a guy who can play center and really run. I think there's potential in the bat. He does hit the ball harder than you expect for a guy who's not very big or physical. He's got bat speed. He's athletic. There's a lot to like. He's going to have to work some on his pitch selection. I don't think he's undisciplined necessarily, but I think he's a guy where those pitches you were able to hit or maybe just spoil in double and triple A, maybe not so much in the big leagues. There might be an adjustment where he's just got to shrink his personal strike zone personal swing zone, pitches he's choosing to swing at. I'll be curious to see what adjustments he makes. Or does he prove me wrong and show he can still get to some of those pitches out of the zone and hit them hard enough to be able to get on base?
Yeah, I think that's going to be key for Sedan Rafaela. And that the best thing is being able to play up the middle. It affords you so much more development time.
Yep.
If the bat is slow to come around too. So I think that bodes well, because you are helping in one facet of the game while you kind of work on the final adjustments you have to make to be a good big league hitter. The Red Sox also brought up Willier Abreu recently. I'm just kind of curious what you think about Abreu as a guy that they picked up, I believe, in the Christian Vasquez trade that they made with the Astros last year. So it's been a little while since he's been in the organization, put up really big numbers at AAA. We've been ragging on AAA all season. The thing that I think is kind of interesting, aside from the power, right? The 22 homers in 86 games, consistently good hard contact from Willier Abreu. So do you see him fitting in somewhere on that Red Sox or in that outfield mix? Like, where do you think he is long-term?
I mean, you got to give this guy a shot, right? I know he's a little older, but he's actually produced really well for, 3 years now? Really, since the pandemic. It's three very credible years in at three different levels in the minors. Now, Asheville 2 years ago in 21, that's a great place to hit. So fine. If you want to throw that one out, fine. But he's hit really well in the last 2 years in three different environments. And I will tell you, scouts hate this guy. Like, I really just do not get good scouting reports on him at all. And I've seen him. It's not terribly impressive to watch. But at some point, don't you have to just say, give him a shot, right? Just see what it is. If this guy's he's making a lot of contact, he's making good contact, good quality contact. He's showing some power. Actually, this year he showed a lot more power. And he's getting on base. Like, he's disciplined. He's drawing a ton. He drew 114 walks last year. We're past the point where teams just dismiss those players entirely. I get it. I know what scouts are saying. I've seen it myself. At some point, you just have to say, let him hit. Let him try. Give him a shot and try him out on something, give him regular playing time and see what happens and see how he responds to pitchers, how pitchers respond to him, and what it looks like that over a longer period of time, especially if you're trying to build. We are past the point where nobody but Oakland would give those guys a shot. I mean, I feel like that's not that long ago where it's like, oh, the A's will just take that guy as a 6-year free agent or pick him up in the Rule 5, and then he'll turn out to be better than anyone expected because scouts as a group, the consensus among scouts was he wasn't any good, but the guy kept putting up productive numbers, putting up production. Yeah, I'm not a big Willier Abreu guy myself, but I acknowledge that's almost two full years of really good production that deserves a chance in the majors. So go for it. Let him play. And hopefully he keeps doing what he was doing the last 2 years in double and triple A.
One more question for you. This comes from the pitching side. We're seeing Ryan Pepio make a bit of an impact for the Dodgers. Missed a ton of time with an oblique injury earlier this season. The thing that's standing out to me in the very limited sample between AAA and the big leagues this season, it's 36 2/3 innings. It's a much improved walk rate, right? The knock on Ryan Pepio, level to levels, but he walks too many guys. When would you start to trust it? Are you there yet? Do you need to see it for another month or a half season? How long do you have to go before you start to say the control problems we've seen in the past are less of a concern going forward?
I mean, the control problems are kind of forever, right? Since he was in college, even, where he's had issues with walks. What I have not loved from what I've seen from him in the big league so far is if he's in the zone, it's a lot of middle, and that's going to get hit. He hasn't been punished much for it so far, but his fastball's got quality to it. But if you're middle, you're going to end up giving up a lot of hard contact over time. I'm less concerned that he's still basically a two-pitch guy. He throws a handful of sliders. I mean, so far in his couple of big league starts, it's like 80-something percent fastball and changeup. And it's a knockout changeup. It's going to be one of the best changeups in baseball. But he is going to have to show that he can command even just those two pitches to the exterior of the strike zone and not be so middle. I look at pitchers like this and worry that it's, Ryan, you got to throw more strikes. Okay, right down the middle. Okay, that's fine as long as you're not getting punished for it. We'll see how this goes. I have a feeling that if he continues to pitch like that, he is going to start giving up a lot more hard contact, and that's on him to make the adjustment. Can you pitch to the perimeter rather than living in the heart? It's not like you never throw to the heart of the zone, and he probably can throw some to the heart of the zone more than a typical pitcher because those two pitches are so good, but he's going to have to show that he can work around or within the strike zone without being in the you know, sort of, if you do the, what is it, the 3x3 grid, he's in the middle. He's in zone 5. That's not good. He's a guy who could probably live quite well in 2 and 8, right? Above and below. And I mean, he can move left and right. I'm not saying he can, but fastballs in 2 and changeups in 8 or below, probably a pretty good, like very dumb, like oversimplified pitching plan for him. But I could see that working, actually. So not saying I don't like Pepiot. He's a prospect. He's always been a prospect. He's going to be something in the big leagues. I need to see a lot more from him in terms of, this is like control over command, right? You throw him more strikes. He's actually not in the zone that much, despite the walk rate, at least in the big leagues. He's getting a lot of chase. That's fine. That works. And I think he will continue to get chase. You're going to have to show me you can stay out of that heart of the zone to believe that, yeah, you're a different pitcher now and you're long-term. So I question whether he's going to be a starter with that kind of command and control trouble.
All right. If he irons it out, he could stay in the back of that rotation. He's got the number 5 spot right now. Tony Gonsolin down for the season. Walker Buehler still trying to work his way back. So we'll get another month's worth of starts potentially to see where things go. And I wonder, too, if we'll get a story eventually, hopefully, from Fabian Ardaia, our Dodgers writer, just digging into, you know, if this continues, how did it happen? Do they give him fewer targets? And to me, like, that'd be the, why is he missing middle? Well, maybe they're trying one target. And he's hitting that one target, and you have to kind of adjust that approach a little bit, because that's going to be problematic if he does keep living in that part of the strike zone. We are going to go on our way out the door. A reminder, you can get a subscription to The Athletic, $1 a month for the first year, gets you in the door at theathletic.com/baseballshow on Twitter, or X as it's now known. You can find Keith at Keith Law. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. Have a safe and happy Labor Day weekend in the States. We're back with you next week.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.